Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We're chatting with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market blog, which we will post a link to below this interview. Now, Mark, the big story this week was the Fed meeting, the 75 basis point rate hike, the continued fall in the U.S. equity markets. That's all very U.S. focused, but in all fairness, when we look around the world, it's the same trend in a lot of different countries. Central banks broadly around the world are getting more aggressive to fight inflation. And the way that they're fighting inflation is by raising rates. The Fed is talking about unwinding the balance sheet, but I don't think that has started yet. Mark, what's your takeaway from generally the global environment here, where central banks, again, reading off the same playbook, except the playbook this year is almost flipped from the playbook it has been in the last couple decades, where easy money has driven markets higher. Now it's tighter monetary policy that's pulling down all the markets.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, and to your point, it's not just the Federal Reserve. I mean, in some ways, that's kind of an important thing to recognize, is that there's been a pivot in market perceptions, helped guided partly by economic data, partly guided by official comments, that have seen the market's expecting officials to become considerably more aggressive. And by that, I mean, whether it's Canada, Australia, the UK, the Eurozone, we've seen, say, roughly 100, in some places, 150 basis point increase in the swaps market for the end of the year. So derivative market anticipating where interest rates are going to be at the end of the year. And they basically jumped, like I say, 100 to 150 basis points in a matter of a couple of weeks. And so I think that, you know, what we're seeing then is, I think that you're right, that when pushes come to shove, yes, many people, many officials thought that inflation was going to be temporary and was not going to become as big of a problem or be as persistent as it has become. And it's as if the market recognizes that officials have also made this pivot. And this is, what does this pivot really mean? I mean, it means that officials will tighten financial conditions. And what does that mean? Tighter financial conditions mean higher interest rates and lower asset prices. So lower asset prices, think about our stocks, equities, our homes, and financial assets. So how does monetary policy work? It works through tightening financial conditions. And through those financial conditions get tighter, demand weakens. And I think that's the point, right? Different central bank officials recognize that they cannot really influence the price of food and energy. So because they can't influence, and they more broadly they say they can't influence the supply side. And so what's left is to curb demand until supply increases or until demand is more in line with supply. And it's not just in the U.S. that this is happening. This is, I'd say, the big surprise this past week was not a central bank we would expect to raise interest rates, but the Swiss National Bank surprised the market, hiked 50 basis points. And of course, they've been seeing some higher inflation, but anybody thought they'd wait for the European Central Bank to raise rates first. It's only a few weeks away. But instead, the Swiss National Bank hiked by 50 basis points and sort of through their forward guidance suggested more rate hikes are coming.
Well, Mark, hasn't the plan all along been to, like you mentioned, hurt the demand side or at least reel in the demand side, since they can't really control the supply side of things? And that means a reverse wealth effect, that the stock markets would correct, that home prices would eventually come down as mortgage rates go up. And isn't that kind of what the plan is here? Do you think there's a point, though, where there's a choke point where the Fed will have so much interference from people upset at the markets, and same thing with other central banks in Europe and maybe even in Canada, where there's enough pushback that maybe they're forced to pause or at least temper their ambitions?
Yeah, no, I think that the pushback won't come from other officials. I think the pushback, I think you're right. I mean, the Federal Reserve and other central banks want to slow things down. And if you're trying to slow things down, how do you know that you've slowed things down too far? I think you only know that in hindsight. And so when, like I say, like on, you know, past talks with you guys, I say things that, like, the Fed's going to raise rates until something breaks. So what's going to break? And I don't think it's going to be just weaker real sector data. I mean, think about what's happened. Just as the Federal Reserve was hiking rates by 75 basis points, that very morning, the U.S. reported much weaker than expected retail sales, sufficiently weak that the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now model that's tracking Q2 GDP lowered it to zero. So after the contraction in Q1, the Atlanta Fed's model, for what it's worth, is saying the economy stagnated in Q2.
Mark, big picture, when we're looking at the GDP numbers, how are you balancing out the wild swings that we've seen in GDP? COVID crash, boy, oh boy, we saw GDP plummet, but then we saw it come screaming back with a double-digit print one quarter and then a couple other strong quarters. Now it's flattened out. What's that telling you about GDP? Again, if you average it out over that time, GDP has been still a slow growth avenue, but there's just been these wild swings.
Yeah, I know. I guess it's been hard to figure out, to talk about numbers and growth patterns, given the huge disruptions. I mean, it's not just, again, I think that we've been hit with a few disruptions. COVID was the big one, but then we've had, the Russian invasion of Ukraine is sort of like, maybe the waters were not still or calm waters, but it threw a huge boulder into those waters. And then China's, COVID seems, these new mutations seem somewhat less fatal. And yet China is acting as if this is through these lockdowns. And for a little bit there, it looked like they were releasing them, but reimposing them as there's a new flare up. So I think that we've really been hit with these few shocks. COVID. But COVID maybe was several shocks, right? The shutdown and then the reopening. And to your point, the strong growth, we know how we got the strong growth. Zero interest rates, very deeply negative real interest rates, and huge amounts of government spending replacing in the U.S. the lost income. When we think about a recession, first I'd say that there's no real definition of recession. The word even comes about to distinguish the end of a business cycle with the Great Depression. Now, before the Great Depression, things were called panics, depressions, crashes. But it's only after the Great Depression that the economists come up with this, the politicians come up with the recession. And so the typical rule of thumb that people use, that people are a lot of people familiar with, is two quarters of negative growth. But the U.S. doesn't even use that. In the U.S., the arbiter of what's a recession is given to the National Bureau of Economic Research. And they typically post-date things, so that by the time they call it a recession, they'll be talking about it in hindsight. The recession began X date. It might have begun. Some people think it began, seeing that University of Michigan sentiment survey at recessionary levels. Powell was very clear on this at his press conference, pushing back against any idea of a weakening economy. He's saying he sees no signs of a broad weakening. And I think this is where it's going to be vulnerable. I think this is what, and to Chad's point, what ultimately is the pushback is not from politicians running for office in November who have become very anti-inflationary in their rhetoric, but it comes from breaking something, and that thing that's going to break is the economy. And so we know, though, that it's going to take more than just weaker demand, which is what the Fed's trying to engineer, to get them to reconsider how aggressive they can be. And I don't think that So I think that because they want weaker numbers, they can't be satisfied with weak numbers to stop doing it. They have to, they can't keep going until they break it.
Well, Mark, as far as the topic of recession, before this word was being used as much, we had mentioned a couple key indicators, and we had brought up when you were on the show, at least a few different interviews, that when energy prices double, and they've done way more than double, they've tripled, or depending on where you start measuring, they've quadrupled. That could be a key indicator. The inversion of the yield curve can be a warning sign, a shot across the bow. We've seen that happen a couple times now. And then seeing these growth metrics start slowing down in GDP, yeah, there's been some wild swings. But, clearly it was negative the first quarter, and it's gone from it was going to be mildly positive to down to zero this quarter. Isn't there enough information showing that the economy is pretty weak to indicate that we could still be going towards a recession? Or where is the evidence that we're not in a recession?
Yeah, so I think that to your point, I think that when you listen to Powell's press conference, the thing he kept on coming back to was the labor market. He did talk about the housing market and recognized that it was slowing, but from very elevated levels. That's fair, but we saw a much larger drop in the U.S. housing starts within 24 hours after the FOMC meeting. But I think that most of Powell's arguments about a strong economy really was with the labor market. He pointed it at several times. I mean, and it's true. I mean, the U.S. economy has created about 2.2 million jobs through the first 5 months of the year, a very strong number. However, I say within that employment number, there's cracks. And I think that the Federal Reserve, I mean, it was a bit late, I think Powell not recognizing it, but in a speech he gave earlier today, Friday, in Washington, it was a broad conference about the U.S. dollar. He did seem to recognize, and I think he will again next week in his testimony before Congress, recognize that the labor market does seem to be slowing. What I suggested as well in my own analysis is that we take a look at those weekly jobless claims. And because they're a weekly number, it's noisy, right? There's different things that could affect it, holidays, storms, those kind of things. So typically, people like myself will take a four-week moving average of that to try to smooth out some of the noise. And that four-week moving average now has risen steadily and is at, I believe it's about a three-month high. And so that to me is already beginning to show us that the labor market's losing some momentum. We saw that in the ADP report, which was not confirmed by the government's estimates. But we're seeing other signs of weakness beginning to creep into the labor market. And so my best guess now is that it's going to continue, that this is a trend, and that, of course, it's going to take some time to be convincing and to percolate up and take more than one soft non-farm payroll number. But I think towards the end of this year, it'll be clear. The economy has lost momentum and it's not getting it back quickly. And part of that, and part of this, like, I don't know about like indicators of a recession, but I sort of think of it more as like the conditions that tend to undermine growth. And besides the monetary tightening and the doubling of the price of energy, which also, you know, we have to throw food in there as well. But the other thing that's taking place and why it's going to be a grind down in the economy is that we've lost fiscal support. Last year, the U.S. ran a budget deficit of about 10.5% of GDP. This year, it's going to be less than 5%. So you have these, on top of the monetary headwinds, you've got the fiscal headwinds, as well as the say, broad tax of higher energy prices.
So, Mark, why aren't more people working? We hear about and we see in our daily life, at least I'm seeing it day to day walking around, restaurants are closed certain days, shops are closed certain days because they don't have the labor. But we didn't lose that many people during COVID. And quite frankly, it seems like a lot of people are just less interested in working, I guess, for the wages offered. But we also don't have these emergency programs that are putting money into people's pockets right now. A, why aren't people working? And B, how are they sustaining their purchases, again, if they're not working?
Yes, I think you're right. You know, probably the best measure of that is the participation rate, which tells you how many people have jobs or are looking for jobs. They're part of the labor market. And I think part of what's happened is that, well, a couple of things that have happened, I think, that we don't usually talk about. We sort of like still in the U.S., we try to make it into a moralistic issue or an issue of people like evaluating incentives. Is it better for me to stay at home or better for me to work kind of thing? But there's a couple of other things that have happened. One is a lot of people have retired. People who were fortunate enough with their 401ks or their retirement plans, instead of during COVID, saw a lot of retirement. Typically what happens is it looks like people, after they retire for a little bit, people still want to be engaged. And they come back to the workforce in some capacity. But coming back to the workforce hasn't happened this time. Or I should say it's happening at a much slower pace. Another thing that I point out, and you know, it depends on where you sit as far as whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, but during COVID, the U.S. really closed down the borders. And the U.S. labor market is about 1 million immigrants shy of where it would have been before COVID. And so I think this also affects things. And when I talk to people, I ask them, especially people who have gig jobs, many of them who have gig jobs now, the flexibility, but also that they're leaving the sort of regular payroll type of jobs, partly because of this new part of the economy has flourished. And that is called the gig workers. But I think there's a lot of these factors makes it more competitive. And I think that In fairness, you know, the wages hadn't really kept up with inflation or the or productivity, right? In some ways, that's what we really have to. That's really the distributional question, right? Through our like hard work, technology, capital investment, we're able to produce a lot of goods. And what really counts is the increase, like the productivity of that. And those productivity gains, how those productivity gains should be distributed between profits and wages, becomes like that's like the eternal issue.
Well, Mark, just one more question on the labor thing before we move on, and that is the, you know, the ingredients are really there for stagflation, except for the labor component. We've got the high inflation, we've got the high energy prices, we've got the stagnant or slowing economy, but the one part that's not really been there to complete the stagflation argument has been we haven't seen high unemployment, and part of that is because of these labor numbers that come out. But we are seeing that there are record amounts of small businesses that have reported the last 3 to 6 months they've been shedding workers. There's things like Elon Musk saying that Tesla is going to scale back 10% of its workers. There was a couple other social media companies that said the same thing. We've seen some tech companies lay people off. If we start seeing that trend continue where there are more layoffs, do you think that would show up in these labor statistic numbers about participation? Are there maybe just jobs that are being eliminated that aren't being tracked?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think both will take place. And I think that you're right, that's what I would focus on for a real indication about whether Powell will be right or not. Part of it, right, of course, is that Powell wants the labor market to weaken. He's been pretty explicit about that, saying the labor market's too hot. So the initial stages of the weakness is going to be welcomed by the Fed. And that's why I think it's hard to avoid a hard landing, because a little bit of weakness is good, but how much weakness are willing to accept? And I think that nobody wants to be bitten by the same dog twice. And I think that Powell is often seen to be too dovish. So I think that we will see deterioration in the labor market. I think that in some ways, you know, that's what evidence is, right? An accumulation of these anecdotes. And of course, the one thing we hadn't talked about a little bit was what's happened to crypto. I see Coinbase, one of the larger platforms, say they're going to be letting go 1,000 workers. So not only did we lose like the wealth effect of roughly $1 trillion out of that crypto space, but also that's another maybe a part where it's not going to be as hiring as quickly, or maybe even laying off workers.
So, Mark, when it comes to the markets, then we are really seeing all stocks pretty much across the board getting sold. There's been the odd little bright light like energy. Some of those stocks have done pretty well. Some of the arguments being that some of the safe haven stocks are holding up a bit better. But still, there does seem to be this general pressure across the board. Is that going to slow any time in the next couple of months, let alone the rest of this year?
Yeah, it always looks horrible when it's falling. But my guess is that the stock market's going to bottom before the economy does. Because the stock market, you know, think about what happened in 2020. The economy was getting crushed, but the stocks, equity investors looking beyond that, looking at the stimulus, that is to say the help that would be brought to bear to help the economy, and better earnings. So yeah, I began thinking that the stock market was trying to bottom here. It proved to be a false one. We gapped lower 2 days in a row last week. And so the charts look ugly still. I'm trying to find some support here. My guess is there still might be room to go down, say, another 100 points or so in the S&P 500, bring us down to closer to 3,500 or so. But yeah, I think that here's the thing, that right, the rule of thumb is don't fight the Fed. And the Fed, like other central banks, are telling us that they want lower asset prices as a way to begin getting squeezing demand and slowing down the economy, bring prices, the ultimate target, back under control.
Well, Mark, one other area that investors are fleeing into, and it is considered a safe haven, is the U.S. dollar. We saw it roll over for a little bit, down from 104 and some change back down to maybe around 101, but it's bounced all the way back up to over 104 again, and some people are projecting it to keep running a little higher. What do you make of the U.S. dollar? And I guess in sympathy, why are the other currencies still so weak?
Yeah, so you're right. You know, we had like a 2 or 3 day pullback in the dollar index, and it's closing the week on a very firm note. We get above 106, and I think we have to be thinking about the test on that 108, 109 area. But the technicals are getting, you know, the momentum indicators didn't really correct with this 3 or 4 day pullback, and so we're getting stretched. So I think that we're going to see that the cap come. So what I'm looking at then is a marginal new high in the dollar index, and then I'll be particularly attentive to a short-term reversal pattern, whether it's a one-day pattern or a couple-day pattern, thinking that we make a marginal new high, and all the sort of the based on the current information that is CPI, what the Fed did and everything, the market's pricing in at 4% Fed funds at the end of the 4% peak in Fed funds, and that's what the Fed. So the Fed and the market sort of agree now, and I think that a lot of the news is known, and so. But I think to your point, it's not just good things in the U.S. But once again, I think that a lot of that our adversaries or our rivals or the dollar's rivals are shooting themselves in the foot. Look at what Japan did. Dollar yen was correcting lower in a way that helped bring stability to this one-way market. And then the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, underscored that it has no plan on changing its monetary policy. It will continue to buy Japanese government bonds, and it really put the market, the whole futures cash market, was disrupted this week by the BOJ's purchases. But this just underscores this divergence between what the U.S. is going to do, what the Federal Reserve is going to do, and what the other central banks are going to do. Other central banks, you know, I think that, as I mentioned before, the market perceives them to have turned more aggressive as well, but still no match for what the Fed's going to be doing. And I think that with the momentum as well and the liquidity of the dollar, I think that at the end of the day, people still prefer that. You can make a case for the Aussie, I think, Canadian dollar. But I think for the Canadian dollar, I think it's really ironically that Canada is much more sensitive to the risk appetite, S&P 500. And I think the S&Ps are down about 6% this week. And so despite Canada's got, I think, solid fundamentals, it should be the fastest growing G7 economy this year. Next week, Canada reports CPI for May. It likely accelerated. Retail sales likely to be strong, though those are April numbers. The market's only pricing in about a 50% chance that the Bank of Canada goes 75 basis points instead of 50 next month. I think that helps push the needle more to that 75. But with a weak S&P 500, it's hard for the Canadian dollar to get much traction. Just today, we fell to new lows for the year. I think the Aussie is interesting as well. But I think the challenge, I think, is that it seemed to be a proxy for world growth. And so I think the market's playing the scenario. Fine, central banks raise interest rates, so we don't want stocks, we don't want bonds. And it means that we have weaker growth, which hurts the currencies like the dollar block or the Scandies that are sort of trade as proxies for growth.
All right, Mark, really appreciate your comments there. Again, the theme really is lower stock markets and central banks raising rates and economic data clearly starting to slow. The jobs numbers, they aren't seeming to help that as more and more people seem to be okay with sitting out the labor market, at least for right now. Man, it seems like we are so data dependent moving forward, mostly dealing with inflation because that's what central banks are fighting, seemingly not caring about the fall in markets broadly. Mark, thank you as always for your time, buddy. We'll chat next week. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks. Good luck to everybody.